accusations levelled against them was that they had expressed doubts about the speed and extent of the Water Conservancy movement. For every 50,000 hectares of irrigated land, they had claimed, 100 villagers paid with their lives. Their removal from power allowed local boss Zhang Zhongliang to take the lead and respond to the call from Beijing. Some 3.4 million farmers, close to 70% of the Gansu workforce, were deployed on irrigation projects that cut across one of the country's most arid provinces. Many of the villages were made to build small dams and reservoirs, but these were not enough to satisfy the leadership. Zhang Zhongliang had a more daring vision of the future, one in which a large water highway would tunnel through snow-capped mountains and span deep valleys to provide water to the central and western regions of the province. The Tao River, quite literally, would move up the mountains, as it was diverted up the hills before flowing 900 kilometers from the Jizhuan Gorges to Xinjiang. As clean drinking water would be brought to parched villages across the province, Gansu would be turned into a giant park as lush and green as the Summer Palace in Beijing. Work started in June 1958 and attracted support from the country's leadership. In September 1958, Marshal Zhu Zi used his calligraphy to signal the momentous nature of the project. The inscription read, "Raising the Tao River up the mountains is a pioneering undertaking by the people of Gansu in transforming nature." But the project was bedeviled by problems from the start. Soil erosion caused frequent landslides, reservoirs filled with silt, rivers turned to mud. Villagers enlisted on the project had to dig caves in the mountains for shelter in the freezing cold of winter, foraging for herbs to supplement a meagre diet of grain. By the summer of 1961, work came to a halt, and in March 1962, the project was abandoned altogether. Total irrigated surface, 0 hectares. Cost to the state, 150 million yuan. Number of work days, 600,000. Cost to the people, inestimable. At its peak, some 160,000 people had been made to work on the project, and most of these were villagers diverted away from agricultural work. At least 2,400 died, some in accidents, but many more as a result of a brutal regime which forced workers to slave day and night in order to reach ever higher targets. Such was the frenzy with which carters pushed villagers that Tongwei, an impoverished county in the mountains situated at the heart of the project, would have one of the highest death rates in the country. Slow starvation and widespread physical punishment changed this desolate place into a site of horror. Targets in Water Conservancy were measured by the number of tons of earth a province could move. This magic number, entirely unrelated to the actual usefulness of the projects being undertaken, was then compared nationwide in a spirit of emulation which determined the political clout of a province. Liu Derun, deputy director of the Office of Water Conservancy, established specifically to supervise the campaign, later recalled that "our daily work consisted of making phone calls to the provinces, inquiring about the number of projects they were building, how many people were involved, and how much earth they had moved. With hindsight, some of the data and figures we gathered were obvious exaggerations, but no one back then had the energy to check them out." In this campaign, the tone was set by Beijing, and in the capital, Mao made sure that everybody got involved. Some 30 kilometers north of Beijing, in a serene and sparsely populated valley, defended from the northern winds by several hills, many of the Ming emperors and their wives lay buried in their underground mausoleums. Protected by statues of elephants, camels, horses, unicorns, and other mythical beasts, which in turn were followed by human sculptures in a funeral cortege, these emperors were now accused of having built vast palaces for themselves while their subjects were exposed to the torrents rushing down from the bare slopes of the mountains. In January 1958, the soldiers of the People's Liberation Army started work on a reservoir near the tombs. By damming a river in the valley, a regular supply of water would help the people. Shock troops were provided by the army. Work proceeded around the clock, manpower being furnished by factories and institutions from the capital, while the press and the radio brought constant coverage to the public. The Ming Tombs Reservoir was to be the flagship of the Great Leap Forward, an example to be emulated by the rest of the country. Soon, tens of thousands of volunteers from the capital joined the effort, including students, cadres, and even foreign diplomats. Work went on in all weathers, and proceeded at night by the light of torches, lanterns, and pressure lamps. Hardly any machinery was used. The people who turned up were given picks, shovels, baskets and poles to dump the rubble in railway wagons, which were shuttled to the dam where it was ground into gravel. Hewn stone was lifted by block and tackle. Then, on the 25th of May 1958, Mao appeared in front of the crowds and posed for the photographers with a bamboo pole slung across his shoulders, two buckets filled with earth dangling from the pole. The photos appeared on the front page of every newspaper, galvanizing a nation. Jan Rowinski, a young student from Poland, participated in the building of this reservoir. He and other volunteers were given a pole with two baskets which they filled with rubble, working their way around the track with straw hats for protection against the summer sun. The workers were divided into units of 10 with an overseer who reported to a group of 100, who in turn answered to the next man up the chain of command. Everybody slept in tents put up by the military or in peasant huts, with banners proclaiming that 3 years of hard work is 10,000 years of happiness. Rowinski was quick to realize that the emperors, denounced for exploiting the common people, had probably used similar tactics to build the Great Wall, the Imperial Canal, and the Ming Tombs, fusing tens of thousands of laborers armed with nothing but a bamboo pole into a docile but efficient workforce. Mikhail Klotchko, a foreign advisor who had volunteered to help, was also skeptical, noting that the few spadefuls of earth he had shoveled around had little propaganda value, although it did provide a welcome opportunity for hundreds of workers to take a few minutes' rest as they gathered around and gawked at the foreigner digging. Most of the work was disorganized, and a few hundred men with excavators and lorries would have done a more efficient job than the thousands of workers compelled to participate, all having to be transported, billeted, and fed for weeks on end. The haste with which the project was executed resulted in major miscalculations, and in April 1958, leaks appeared in the reservoir. A Polish expert on soil solidification was flown in from Gdansk to freeze the ground, preventing the water from escaping. At long last, the dam was formally opened with a brass band and officiating dignitaries praising Mao and paying tribute to the voluntary workers. As the reservoir was built in the wrong location, it dried up and was abandoned after a few years. Work at the Ming Tombs may have been an exciting event for some foreign students, but most people dreaded the back-breaking work. Mao himself started perspiring after half an hour of digging in the sun, his face turning bright red. "So little effort and already I'm dripping with sweat," he said, before retiring to the command tent for some rest. His immediate entourage, secretaries, bodyguards and private doctor, were also sent to the reservoir by Mao. "Just work until you are exhausted. If you really can't stand it, just let me know." Group 1, as they were known, remained a privileged elite, sleeping on quilts on the floor of a classroom when everybody else spent the night on reed mats outdoors. They were also spared the scorching heat of early summer, being assigned a night shift by the general in charge. Li Chitsui, Mao's personal doctor, was healthy and still young at 38 years of age, but the digging and carrying was the most arduous work he had ever done in his life. After 2 weeks he was exhausted, aching in every limb and trembling with cold at night. Every reserve of energy in his body had been used up. Nobody in Group 1 wanted to continue, not even the strong bodyguards. But who would want to be labelled a backward element by suggesting that they quit? Mercifully, they were ordered back to Zhongjianhai. But outside the capital, the pressure was much greater, and villagers were the ones who bore the brunt of the campaign. They were not called off after a mere 2 weeks of work to return to the luxuries of an elite cadre lifestyle. They were marched off in groups to construction sites far away from home and family, made to perform exhausting labour all day long for months on end, sometimes throughout the night without any rest, poorly fed and barely clothed, and exposed to the elements, come snow, rain, or heat. Yunnan provides a good example of what happened far away from the glare of publicity. Some villages in the subtropical province started work on reservoirs in the winter of 1957-8, but the local party boss was unimpressed. In early January 1958, Si Fuzi, the man who a few months later so ruthlessly purged his colleagues in the anti-rightist movement, complained loudly that far too many farmers were laggards who failed to perform their collective duties in the slack winter months. 8 hours of work a day was a strict minimum for every adult, while the amount of food consumed by workers on irrigation projects should be curtailed. Then, on the 15th of January, the People's Daily listed Yunnan as one of the worst performers in the Water Conservancy campaign. Determined to catch up, Si called an emergency meeting the following day. Up to half the workforce in the province should join the movement, he commanded, and villagers were to work up to 10 hours a day, through the night if necessary. Shirkers should be punished, and targets should be met at any cost. Cadres who failed to comply would be sacked. Coming in the midst of an unfolding anti-rightist campaign which had already stripped thousands of local cadres of their jobs, this was no idle threat. Results followed promptly. On the 19th of January, the People's Daily reported that Yunnan, singled out only a few days earlier, now had 2.5 million people, a third of the workforce, moving earth. Emboldened, Si Fuzi declared that the province would be completely irrigated within 3 years. The cost of success was high. In Shuxiong, near a highland lake as large as a sea, farmers enrolled on irrigation projects were routinely cursed and beaten. Villagers were tied up for stealing a few vegetables. Others who failed to work hard enough were stabbed with knives by carders trying to impose a ruthless work regime. A makeshift labour camp took care of recalcitrant elements. Party leaders higher up the chain of command were aware of these practices. In April 1958, a team was sent by the Yunnan Provincial Party Committee to investigate the county. Hopeful rumours began to circulate among the villagers. One courageous individual trying to muster support for a collective grievance about insufficient food and long working hours. He was denounced as a reactionary and a saboteur in the final report sent to Si Fuzi. Some 130 kilometres to the east of the provincial capital, Kunming, in the midst of a primeval forest with craggy mountains shaped out of sand and stone by erosion, Luliang County had been savaged by the Provincial Party Committee for giving in to farmers' rightist demands for grain in 1957. The new leader, Chun Shunyan, rigidly adhered to the party line, organising military squads who patrolled the village streets with leather whips, making sure that even sick villagers went out to work in the fields. The first cases of death by starvation appeared in February 1958. By June, edema or water retention was widespread, and 1,000 villagers died of hunger, most of whom had worked on the Sichong Reservoir. Edema happens when fluids accumulate in the feet, ankles and legs, or beneath the skin in other parts of the body. In developed countries, it can be caused by mild changes in behaviour, for instance by eating too much salt or standing a lot when the weather is warm. In poor countries, however, it is caused by a lack of protein and is seen as a symptom of malnutrition. It is sometimes called famine edema. In Luliang, Medical teams were dispatched on several occasions to investigate these cases. But in the midst of the anti-rightist campaign, none had the courage to identify edema as a condition generally caused by hunger, as was well known in a country with a long record of famine. Some doctors even wondered whether it might be a contagious disease and prescribed antibiotics instead of bed rest and food. At first, the bodies of the dead were buried in coffins, but after a few months they were simply covered in mats and dumped in the ditches and ponds near construction sites. Yunnan was no exception. All over China, farmers were being driven to the edge of starvation on gigantic irrigation schemes, pushed hard by carders afraid of being labelled rightists. Having spent half an hour shoveling gravel himself, Mao was in a good position to see the human cost of the irrigation campaign. In March 1958, as he listened to a report by Jiang Weiqing on irrigation in Jiangsu, he mused that Wu Qipu claims he can move 30 billion cubic meters. I think 30,000 people will die. Zhong Xisheng has said that he will move 20 billion cubic meters, and I think that 20,000 people will die. Weiqing only promises 600 million cubic meters. Maybe nobody will die. Mass mobilization on water conservancy schemes continued unabated for several years, claiming the lives of hundreds of thousands of exhausted villagers already weakened by hunger. In a chilling precursor of Cambodia under the Khmer Rouge, villages in Tsing Shui, Gansu, called these projects the Killing Fields. Chapter 5. Launching Sputniks. Charts with rising targets, beautifully drafted with color-coded diagrams, made a stark contrast with the killing fields. As targets rocketed skywards in every conceivable domain, from grain output and steel production to the number of wells dug in the countryside, a dark chasm appeared between a world of slogans and the reality on the ground. Behind the pressure which produced this gap was the hand of Mao. In informal exchanges, he needled and goaded local bosses to commit to ever higher production targets. Zhou Xiaochuo, the cautious leader of Mao's native Hunan, was one of the first to be harangued in November 1957. "Why can't Hunan increase its agricultural production?" Mao asked, on a visit to the provincial capital, Changsha. "Why do the Hunan peasants still plant only one crop of rice a year?" After Zhou explained that the weather permitted only a single crop a year, Mao pointed out that Zhejiang was on the same latitude as Hunan and planted two crops of rice. "You are not even studying other experiences. That's the trouble," Mao continued. "We will study the matter then," Zhou responded meekly. "What do you mean, study?" Mao demanded. "You won't get anywhere with your study. You can go now," he added, dismissing the party leader. He opened a book and began to read. A humiliated Zhou then promised, "We'll try to start two plantings right away." Mao ignored him. A few months later, when Zhou's representative met the chairman in Beijing, Mao lavished praise on Hunan instead. Hunan produced half the country's wheat. "What do you think of that?" Then he shared his disappointment with Hunan. Luxembourg had a population of 300,000, but produced 3 million tons of steel a year. Now how many people were there in Hunan? Mao also sent close allies to hammer home the message. Just as Deng Xiaoping was his trusted lieutenant in the campaign against rightists, Tan Zunlin was a zealot put in charge of agriculture. A short man, topped by a bush of dense hair with thick glasses and trout lips, he was a close follower of Mao and an ally of Ke Qingxi, the rising star of Shanghai. He was described by a former colleague as a sarcastic man who was ruthlessly mission-oriented. His advice to colleagues who were summoned by the chairman was to proffer instant self-criticism, whether or not they were at fault. Tan spent many months touring the country, whipping up the pressure behind the great leap forward. He was unimpressed with what he saw in Hunan, a province he considered a laggard. As he threatened to denounce it as politically backward, a reluctant Zhou Xiaoshu started inflating the crop figures. Outside the corridors of power where one-to-one encounters took place, the telephone was used to keep up the pressure. In a country the size of China, it allowed a leader to stay in touch with his subordinates regardless of physical distance. In the frenzy to produce more steel, for instance, Si Fuqi would phone around Yunnan to impress on county secretaries the danger of falling behind neighbors Guangxi and Guizhou. The party secretary, in turn, was regularly given updates by the Ministry of Metallurgy. On the 4th of September 1958, for instance, the latest results were phoned in by Beijing. Then on the 6th of September, a speech by Mao was transmitted in a telephone conference, followed by a talk on steel targets by Bo Yibo on the 8th of September, by Peng Shen on the 11th of September, and by Wang Heshu on the 16th of September. In the meantime, countless other conferences on agriculture, industry and collectivization were given by telephone from the capital. How often the phone was used we do not know, but at the height of the campaign one local cadre in a commune in Guangdong estimated that some 90 telephone conferences took place in a single season in 1960 to ensure close planting, sowing seeds more densely in the hope that the crop would increase, also known as close cropping. Pressure was also maintained through the ad hoc party gatherings called by Mao, who dominated the agenda to promote new ideological themes and escalate production targets. Bo Yibo, one of the planners taken to task by Mao for opposing a surge in output, contributed in no small measure to the frenzy by replacing a single set of national targets with a system of dual planning at the Nanning meeting in January 1958. To this Mao added a third set. It worked as follows. The center was to have one set of targets that had to be achieved, while the second plan was merely expected to be accomplished. This second plan was handed over to the provinces and became their first set of targets, which had to be reached at all cost. The provinces were then asked to have a second plan reflecting what they expected to be accomplished, making for three sets in total. The system percolated downwards to the counties, in effect adding a fourth set of production plans. As the national targets were ceaselessly revised upwards at party meetings, the whole system of defined and desired targets created an orgy of inflation all the way down to the village, resulting in a great leap in targets. A process of emulation further added to the political tension. Mao not only denigrated timorous colleagues and praised the more radical ones in full view of their subordinates, he was also inclined to compare everything and everyone with something else to heighten the competitive spirit. Hunan was juxtaposed to Luxembourg in steel production. China was stacked up against Britain when it came to industrial output. Gansu was set against Hunan in the irrigation drive. This, too, was enshrined in the directives Mao distributed to party leaders at Nanning. To boost its competitive spirit, the whole nation was to engage in comparison. Regular reviews in endless meetings at all levels bestowed three categories of designation on provinces, cities, counties, communes, factories, and even individuals, all on the basis of their achievements. A red flag was granted to those judged to be advanced, a grey flag was given to those considered mediocre, and a white flag was punishment for the backward. Handed out during meetings after work, these symbolic designations, sometimes drawn on a blackboard next to a unit's name, had the power to confer shame in a society in which even the slightest lack of political enthusiasm could cause somebody to be labelled a rightist. The whole country became a universe of norms, quotas and targets, from which escape was all but impossible, as loudspeakers blasted slogans, cadres checked and appraised work, and committees endlessly ranked and rated the world around them. And classification of individual performance would increasingly determine the kind of treatment meted out, down to the ladle of gruel in the canteen in times of hunger. Mao was clear. Compare? How should we compare? What we call comparison is really compulsion. A county official recalled the experience thus. That year, we pooled all our able hands together to work on water well drilling, leaving spring farming unattended. The prefecture party committee held a pingyi, assessment and comparison, meeting, at which we received a red flag for well drilling and a white flag for spring farming. I went back to the county party committee to report this and got blasted by the party secretary. How could you have left with a red flag but come back with a white flag? I realized then that the problem was very serious. I myself could be picked as a white flag. Thus I had to leave my sobbing wife, who was due to give birth soon, and my dying sister, who was infected with tetanus, to go back to the worksite in the mountains. Soon all of China was in the grip of target fever, as fantastic figures for agricultural and industrial output competed for attention. These claims were trundled out at party meetings and publicized by a powerful propaganda machine, covering the leaders behind the latest record in glory. The numbers were stratospheric, and achieving a new high was called launching a Sputnik, in honor of the first satellite hurled into space by the socialist camp the previous year. To launch a Sputnik, to join the party in combat, to work hard for a few days and nights, were ways of getting a red flag. In Chiasan, Henan, soon to become the country's first people's commune, known as the Sputnik Commune, a goal of 4,200 kilos of wheat per hectare was set in February 1958. As 6,000 activists roamed the countryside with a river of banners, posters, leaflets and slogans, targets were cranked up. By the end of the year, an entirely fictitious level of 37.5 tons per hectare was promised. Many of these records were achieved on Sputnik fields, high-yield experimental plots touted by local cadres keen on setting new records. These were generally limited to a small strip of land in any one collective farm, but the plots acted as showcases for new agricultural techniques that found a much wider application. Increasing the yield encouraged a scramble for fertilizer. Every conceivable kind of nutrient was thrown onto the fields, from weed dragged from the sea and garbage salvaged from refuse heaps to soot scraped from chimneys. Animal and human waste was carried to the fields by endless rows of people, sometimes until deep into the night. Where excrement was traditionally viewed as a dirty and polluting substance by the many minority people who lived along the outer reaches of the empire, outdoor toilets were built for the first time, the party riding roughshod over local sensibilities. Collecting it became a task assigned to punishment teams. Human waste extended to hair, and in some Guangdong villages, women were forced to shave their heads to contribute fertilizer or face a ban from the canteen. But most of the time, buildings made of mud and straw were torn down to provide nutrients for the soil. Walls of buildings where animals had lived and especially where they had urinated, such as stables, could provide useful fertilizer. At first, old walls and abandoned huts were destroyed, but as the campaign gained momentum, entire rows of houses were systematically razed to the ground, the mud bricks shattered and strewn across the fields. In Macheng, nestled against the south of the Dabi mountain range in Hubei, thousands of houses were demolished to collect fertilizer. In January 1958, the model county was exalted by Wang Rensong, party secretary of the province, for reaching a rice yield of 6 tons per hectare. "Let us learn from Macheng," the People's Daily declared rapturously. Once it had been praised by Mao for its experimental plots, Macheng became a shrine. In the following months it attracted 500,000 cadres, including Zhou Enlai, Foreign Minister Chen Yi, and Li Xianyan. By August, a new record was achieved with a yield of 277 tons of rice per hectare. The era of miracles, the propaganda machine proclaimed.